ויומס יוסף בן 110 שנים ויחנתו אוסו ויסם בארון במצרים. Joseph died at the age of 110 and they embalmed him and he was placed in a coffin in Mitzrayim. So ends Chumash Bereishis with the story of the death and the burial of Yosef HaTzadik. The Zohar was intrigued by one word in this pasuk, by the word Vayisem, which is spelled Vav Yud Yud Sin Mem. It's rare in Tanakh. There may be one other place that this word is used. And the Zohar asks, why two yuds? Trei yudin amai. Why these two yuds of Vayisem ba'aron b'mitzrayim? And the Zohar says, Ela, Yosef notale bris lesata, v'notale bris le'ela. The each yud stands for a different bris, a different covenant that Yosef had. One was a supernal, an upper, a higher covenant with the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, and one was a lower covenant, a covenant that has to do more with this world. Istalek me'alma, when Yosef died, ishtave betrei arone, he was therefore buried in two arones, in two coffins, or an aron really means an any enclosed object. One was Vayisem ba'aron b'mitzrayim, the aron l'sata. The lower covenant was emphasized by his body that was placed in the aron in Mitzrayim, and the other one by the aron kodesh that went along with him eventually back to Eretz Yisrael, and there that symbolized the bris le'ela, the upper or the higher covenant. And that's why we have Vayisem, he was placed in an aron with two yuds, because he was a man of two britot, of two covenants, an upper and a lower covenant. Our Joseph, Rabbi Yosef Burg, whom we are here to memorialize on this Shloshim, lived not to the age of 110, but to the age of 90, 91, and he was not embalmed. But the rest of the commentary of the Zohar holds firm for him, as it did for the first, the original Joseph. His was a double covenant, Trei Yudin, and he was true to both of them, as the Yiddish expression goes, zu Gott und zu Leid. Our words of tribute to his memory are meant to cover both Yosef Burg's Bris de Le'ela and his Bris de Le'sata. Dr. Burg dedicated his life to his people. That was his Bris de Le'sata. Dedicated his life to his people, and if I may disagree with him, that in national religious is not the hyphen that count, but the relation of the two of them was somewhat different. I believe that his dedication did not stem from a mere nationalist perspective to which was superadded a religious item, but rather that his Zionism, his nationalism, issued from a profoundly religious perspective. The religious was the foundation of his nationalist, and all that he stood for was not a kind of artificial synthesis, but it was organic. It came from within. I don't think he said that because the chap was for a hyphen, but this, I believe, was really his fundamental outlook on his Zionism, on his nationalism. It was a spiritual perception that motivated him, and that superbly qualified him to be a leader of religious Zionism for these many, many years, ultimately as the president of World Mizrahi. As a leading statesman and a minister in so many different posts in Israel, for over 35 years, he distinguished himself by sheer competence and also used his position to help so many Torah institutions. He was a man of ethics, a man of ethics, and he was not a man who was ashamed to admit he ever made a mistake. Therefore, he was able to elicit the trust and the confidence of the leaders of Israel. When Menachem Begin wanted someone to conduct the autonomy talks in his day, he didn't choose Dayan, he chose Yosef Burg. It was Burg who told the Palestinians for the first time it made world headlines. He pointed out to them the importance of Yerushalayim to Am Yisrael, that Yerushalayim is mentioned some 165 times in Tanakh and not a single time in the Quran. In his early days, he was a student of the great Gaon, Rabbi Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, of Switzerland, and he began his career as a teacher. And in a sense, he remained a teacher, but in a larger and a more influential and more spacious and more capacious classroom, that of the entire country, the entire nation. However, circumstances and interests took him out of the classroom and took him into politics, to government, to Pearl Mizrahi, to Medinat Yisrael. Yet throughout his entire career, Joseph Berg remained primarily a learned man. Even in the ranks of the Zionist movement of his day, the early days, both before and after the state, when you had many people who knew the Klei D'Oisius, who were proud of being scholars, during and after the establishment of the state, he was acknowledged as a Talmud Chacham, as a scholar, but a great majority of his efforts went into the struggle for the state, for its founding and for its endurance. And we're all the poorer, really, for all the further scholarship that a man of his incredible talents might have achieved, even as we are so much richer for the accomplishments that will remain to his eternal credit. Dr. Berg was always accessible, always accessible. He possessed the common touch, a touch of irreverence and charm. Like the biblical Joseph, who was a high minister in Egypt, our Joseph was a high minister in Israel, and like Yosef HaTzadik, he had a streak, if you might forgive me, of boyishness, of a kind of benevolent mischievousness or playfulness about him that always made you think you had to be happy in his presence. You had to be alert and sensitive. You could not be verschlafen in the presence of Joseph Berg because of this particular element in his personality. Now, humor, you know, has been studied a great deal, especially in the last 100 or so years since Freud's Wit and the Unconscious. Humor can be a way of self-revelation, sometimes of things you don't want to reveal. Humor can be a weapon to hurt people. With Dr. Berg, there was plenty of humor, but it never, never was used as a weapon. He had a famous sense of humor, which was leavened with a graciousness that was remarkable for its lack of ego by a man of considerable, in fact, great achievements. Let me tell you a story that happened, it must be about 10, 12, 15 years ago. It was a Shabbos Vayera, and I happened to be in Israel, and in those days, the Hechel Shlomo was the scene of a base. It was the base of Knesset before the Beit Knesset Agadol was built. So in the lobby and the gallery of Hechel Shlomo is where the davening took place. That Shabbos morning, I decided to daven at Hechel Shlomo, and Dr. Berg noticed me. He came over to me, and since it was Pashas Vayera, he said, V'aye haseh li'oyla, nuvenkum darlam of aliyah. And I answered him immediately, Bahar Hashem Yeirov, and the Berg Vetzavaisen Megetlach. I'm telling you this not because I want to convince you of my ability and repartee, that's not the point, but because thereafter, for a number of years, very often, and it happened three or four times when I met Dr. Berg and other people are present, he said, I want to tell you something that Lamb said. It wasn't his chachma that he repeated. It was my chachma that he repeated. There's a certain elegance of personality and character in a man who doesn't boast of himself, but attributes the chachma, the pikhus, whatever you wish, to somebody else, including someone considerably younger than himself. So I learned much from that graciousness of Dr. Berg and his appreciation of others. I believe that his humor, and you can't discuss Dr. Berg without talking about this particular aspect of his personality. His humor, I believe, had two functions. One was, like so much of humor, to entertain because it lightened the load of living by people whom he came in contact. Everyone has a pickle tzaras. Everyone carries a load of worries and concerns and depression. And sometimes wit and humor can lighten that load. That's the way you felt in the presence of Dr. Berg. And there was another aspect to his humor, and that was that it highlighted the absurdity of existence of so many people. Many people, many humans, maybe most, really are amusing when they think they are being very serious. Life is a very, very serious enterprise. Yet very often people think they are being serious, and they really are acting ultimately like clowns. If we step back and view the world in a broad perspective, think of our contemporaries, of course not of ourselves, and we think of our contemporaries and view them, we decide, we come to the conclusion that most of what is said and done is not vicious, it's not constructive, rather it's pretentious, a little silly, somewhat comical, and sometimes it's comical tragically. This is a kind of philosophy of man as clown, and it's worth pondering because it should make us respond to the foibles of others not with a smirk but with a smile, not with a chuckle, with a chuckle rather than with a frown. Sometimes people do things that annoy us, that surprise us, that shock us, but when you realize that it's more comical than it is malicious, you can live better with them and live better with yourself. Dr. Berg's renowned wit was incisive, engaging, charming, but it also had negative consequences. Negative for him, because for one thing, it overshadowed the very serious side of this man of high intelligence and commitment and communal and political achievement. It became easy to dismiss him, as some of his political enemies did, with a wave of the hand, conceding, yes, it's a brilliant humor, but what about intellectual and spiritual attainments? You know, he was not the first one to suffer because of the excess of ability in one area of his life. I think of Rabbi Amiel Zechena Levelcha. I once talked to my Talmidim, I was giving a shiur, and I quoted Rav Amiel in his halacha. They were unaware that Rav Amiel had any halacha. He was a great Talmud Chacham, but he was such a good darshan that people forgot that he's also a great Talmud Chacham. It's the fate of many people who have a diversity of talent, that one talent stands out so much, at least superficially, that the major talent is overlooked and overshadowed. And that is unfortunate, because then people are blind to the authentic quality and gravitas of the man. And therefore, there were those who asher lo yoda es Yosef, who didn't know or want to recognize, understand, and value him, his insights, and his masterful talents and deep commitment. But most of all, I think we shall miss his overarching public philosophy, and that was moderation. That was the leitmotif of his career. I believe you will believe me when I say from personal experience that it's not easy to be a moderate. Extremists on both sides have a heyday with you. They're relentless in their attacks, and there are many otherwise rational people who sneer and repeat the usual platitudes that moderation lacks compassion, it's a sign you can't make up your mind, it compromises undignified, it manifests a lack of principle. You know the litany as well as I do. And that kind of charge is always brought against people of moderation. So maybe es schwerz sein naid, but believe me, es noch schwerz sein a mensch. But that did not deter Dr. Berg. His most characteristic ambition in politics was moderation. And he was a moderate both by disposition as well as by conviction. And he advocated moderation both in his nationalist politics and in his religious conception and work in society, in the society of our people. Yet in the end, sorry to say, he did not prevail. He did not prevail. Moderation took a back seat to the more radical views that prevailed both in the religious Zionist camp and in society in general, and in the Orthodox community generally, both here and there. The question I ask sometimes is, was he really a failure? This unusual man who had a fabulous memory, a polyglot who spoke some six languages, this Yosef, who was a man of Ksones Pasim, the shirt of many colors, means a man of many talents and a colorful personality. This man who was so honorable and the Ki Chapayim of Vadalevov, sophisticated, scholarly, a musmach and a PhD, a man possessed of a nimble and capacious mind. Was he a failure in this most characteristic and important quest in his career? And if he was, does that diminish from his gestalt, from his stature, as Dr. Borg recedes from the contemporary scene in Jewish history? Indeed, how will history judge him? Let me try to answer that from my point of view from a somewhat larger perspective. Let us look back at the Avos HaUmah, the founders of our people, and see how they fared with regard to success and failure in their lives, and see if any lesson can be derived therefrom. Moshe Rabbeinu was probably the greatest, not probably, was the greatest human being who ever lived. Yet was Moshe Rabbeinu a success in everything that he did? No. What's the most tragic element of his life? He did not succeed in leading his people to the promised land. Did not. He died before he was able to achieve it. Nor was he always happy with his people. If you were to ask Moshe, I'm sure he would have said that he had failed in converting his people into an Am Hashem and the Am Segula that he wanted them to become. David HaMelech was a success in so many ways, but the one thing he wanted most, to build a Beis HaMikdash, he was not permitted to do, so he failed. Yehuda ben Yaakov became the progenitor of Malchus, of all the kings of Yehuda. And yet, he left history with a moral question mark on certain parts of his life. Yosef HaTzadik, was such a marvelous success in what he did in Egypt. And yet, Malchus was denied to him by his father, who loved him more than anyone else. The late Maurice Samuels, who was a great Zionist publicist, I don't know how many of you remember him, he once wrote a book, a fantastic book, which ought to be republished. I don't think it's available anymore, called Certain People of the Book. Maurice Samuels, Perish HaChumash. And he has a chapter on Joseph, and the chapter is entitled The Brilliant Failure. Yaakov Avinu, who was the Bechir HaAvos, yet wrestled with an angel, which according to Chazal was the Sorosh El Esav, the guardian angel of Esav, prefiguring the centuries, millennia-long battle between Jerusalem and Rome, between us and the Western world, as Chazal have interpreted it. And yet, even though he prevailed, he left the Hutzoleya al Yerecho, the scars remained. The victory, the triumph, was not perfect. Yitzchak's greatest achievement took place when he was on the Akedah. When he looked up from the Akedah, when he looked into the eyes of his father and didn't flinch, didn't recoil, didn't dodge, didn't duck as Abraham's knife was raised above him. Yet those eyes were dimmed. According to the Agoda, they were dimmed because when the angels saw what was about to happen, they cried, and the fiery tears of the Malachim came into the eyes of Yitzchak and damaged his sight thereafter. So that when he was older, he ultimately became blind. Vayiki zoke Yitzchak, vatechena einav meraos. He couldn't see. And not only couldn't he see optically, but he also couldn't see in other ways, so that he was not able to distinguish quite well between one son and another son. Avram Avinu's great quest was for a son, for a child. Great quest. Mati tein li v'anochi holech ariri, he said to the Rabbanu Shalom. Bold words. What can you give me as long as I'm childless? All he wanted was this son. And when he got this son, he loved him passionately. So that when the Rabbanu Shalom ordered the Akedah, he told him, Kachna es bincha, es yechidcha, es asher ahavta, es Yitzchak. Give me your, as Chazal say, he said, take your son. Abraham said, which son? He said, your only son. I have two only sons. This is an only son for Sarah. This is an only son for Hagar. He says, Asher Ahavta, which you love. He said, both. Then he said, Yitzchak. But the Ahavta was there. The Ahava that he felt for his son Yitzchak was an incredible Ahava, a rare, magnanimous, magnificent Ahava. Then we brought him up on the Akedah. And the word from the Malach came, stop. Stop. Don't do it. He said, V'lo chasachta es bincha es yechidcha mimeni. Avram said to the Malach, don't do it, because now I know that you did not spare your bincha es yechidcha. And a moment later, when the Rabbanu Shalom acknowledges Avram's greatness, he says, V'lo chasachta, the same words, es bincha es yechidcha mimeni. What's missing there? Asher Ahavta. Because at the moment that Avraham made up his mind that the Akedah was going to take place, he was faced with the conflict of Avas Hashem and Avas HaBen, Rachamei Ha'aval HaBen. And the whole trick of the Akedah, the whole chachma of the Akedah, the whole purpose of the Akedah was to show that Avas Hashem must prevail. So what did Avraham sacrifice, really? He sacrificed the Avas HaBen. Not that he stopped loving him, but that that love no longer had that preeminent quality that it had before the Akedah. So Avraham gave up. He failed in this one area. Succeeded in so many things. Succeeded in Avas Hashem. But he had to surrender when it came to the Ahava for his own child. So all of these people I mentioned, all of these Avoisa Umma whom I mentioned, were all successful in so many ways. Yet each was a failure in one of the most important things, if not the most important things, in his life. Each one had great triumphs, and each has very serious failures. They were scarred, they were blind, they were emotionally wounded, they were frustrated, they were failures. Why so? What is the Torah trying to teach us? It's trying to teach us that perfection is not granted to Basav Adam. We can all be successful, but none of us can be successful in everything. There always is some chip in our armor. True perfection, complete perfection, is not a human quality. Two reasons. First of all, I believe that just as Gilui Shechina, the revelation of God to man, is filled with mortal peril for man. Ki lo yirani ha'odom v'chai, man can see God and survive. And not only that, even in beyond the direct revelation, the Baal Shem Tov says in some places, quoted in some places, that the Baal Shem Tov said that when he is involved in tefillah and facing the Rabbanu Shel Olam himself, the Shechinah, he could have died two or three times. You can't face greatness without surrendering something in yourself. Every encounter with greatness, every form of greatness, leaves its painful mark. The prophet who faces the Rabbeinu Shel Olam is singed by proximity with him. God is at fire, ki esh ochlahu, and the prophet, every prophet, is hurt in some way. Genius often warps one's personality. It warps it. Great talent is often acquired at the expense of an outsized ego. Great wisdom is sometimes results in a deficit of normality and filled with unexpected pettiness. Wealth often masks dark fears of defeat of all kinds. Every success exacts a price. Only the Rabbanu Shel Olam is perfect without blemish. Lahagid ki yashar Hashem suri v'lo avlosa bo. Only God is perfect without blemish. This is a law of the spirit inscribed in our very existence as human beings. So every greatness takes away something from us. Second, it tells us that man must never falsely presume that he is perfect, lest he accelerate his own disastrous and calamitous end. Because every success breeds its own homegrown failure. Such scars are the sacrifice that success offers up on the altar of our humility, and such defeats are the tributes that excellence pays to our very humanity. As Chazal said in the Medrash in Keheles Rabbah, Ein Adam Yotzei Min HaOlam V'Chatzi Ta'avaso Biyado. No one leaves the world with as much as 50% of his ambitions realized. When we are young, we have great ambitions. By the time life is over, less than half have been realized, even by the most successful. If you are an Adam Yotzei Min HaOlam, if you're a mensch, that means you had high ambitions, great ambitions. And then, Ein Adam Yotzei Min HaOlam V'Chatzi Ta'avaso Biyado, you can't realize half of them. Unless, of course, you have very few and very modest ambitions. So you must know in advance, have great dreams, but do not expect perfection. Failure is written into our very humanity. So I'm back to my question. How will history judge Dr. Yosef Burg? It will, I believe, this all of us can only conjecture, it will, I believe, grant him admiration, especially for the way he espoused moderation and used his talents to achieve it. The Derech Hashem, as the Rambam calls it. And it will count his failure to achieve all of it in our bewildering and contradictory age as a sign that his dreams surpassed the ability of his peers to realize them. In the words of the great poet Robert Browning, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or else what's a heaven for? Dr. Burg reached for the heavens, great ambitions. His goal was a polity, a government, a society that eschewed and denied all manifestations of extremism. For a religious community that was appealing because it was reasonable in its invitation to Chaye Kedusha. For a Yiddishkeit that attracted by its Menschlichkeit. But in the grand tradition of the founders of our Am Yisrael, what he wanted and valued most was denied to him. Politically, the people he worked with most closely went to self-defeating extremes. And our community, showed signs of transforming unreasonableness, exclusiveness, and a rejection of all forms of culture outside our own as virtues. So here we are gathered to say our last farewells here from America to Israel, to declare that his frustrated ambitions for us should never be forgotten. They should be revived and allowed to inspire another generation all over again. Dr. Burg was honorable in his successes and brilliant in his failures. Let's learn from him that quick successes are often doomed to vanish, and noble failures ultimately prevail in the fullness of time if there are others who carry on the struggle. Our friend and leader, Dr. Burg, kept his faith with both covenants, the Bris de Le'ela and the Bris de Le'Sata, the upper and the lower covenants. He was, on one hand, the Yerei Shemayim and a Talmud Chacham, and on the other hand, a man of honor, probity, integrity, sociability, and high intelligence. One Aaron carried his earthly remains to interment in Eretz Yisrael. The second Aaron is carried in the hearts of his fellow Jews, especially those of us, all of us, who cherish the spiritual, intellectual dimensions of this extraordinary Jew, whose life was dedicated to Am Yisrael, to Medinas Yisrael, and to Toras Yisrael. In a word, to us. His loss is really, really grievous to his party, to his country, to his family, to his friends, and to the cause he served so nobly, which remains bereft of his great leadership. But his voice need not be stilled and should continue to inspire and encourage us, because ultimately, I believe, there is no choice, but ultimately, his shita will prevail. His biography should be taught in our schools to show another generation that idealism and pragmatism can dwell together, that Yiddishkeit and Menschlichkeit are not incompatible, that religion and Zionism are not antonyms, that Torah